This week on The Take, we're marking 1 year since a pair of devastating earthquakes hit Turkey and Syria with a new digital interactive. Listen and watch stories of survival, recovery, and coping with the grief at aljazeera.com/earthquakes. Again, that's aljazeera.com/earthquakes.
More than 150 days into Israel's war on Gaza, the airdropping of humanitarian aid aimed at news cameras, not the people who need it. Palestinians have Washington to thank for that. Next door, in El Sisi's Egypt, what's taking place in Gaza is testing the bounds of political dissent and crimes against memory, the taking of a people's history and culture and erasing it. You've seen the images in the media coverage, the U.S. airdropping aid into northern Gaza to feed hungry Palestinians. Headline news, but also a textbook case of cognitive dissonance on Washington's part. Dropping food while continuing to provide Israel with bombs to pulverize Gaza. What makes the starvation there different is that it's deliberate. Israel is manufacturing this famine. It has systematically attacked what little aid gets through. Last week, more than 100 Palestinians who lined up to get some flour to cook with were slaughtered by Israeli troops. Israel's response to that atrocity was straight out of its misinformation playbook. Deny, then blame Palestinians, then accept limited responsibility. We've seen it so many times before. What is unprecedented, though, is the scale of what is now unfolding in Gaza. The hunger, the mass killing, the rewriting of the map, and the gulf between what is happening on the ground and the obsolete narratives coming out of the White House and the mainstream news media has never been bigger.
The U.S. airdrops into the Gaza Strip are pure theater.
U.S. military planes making the first airdrop to Gaza.
The U.S. has been supplying thousands of tons of goods to the Gaza Strip, but those have been high explosives. And to then claim that somehow this is ameliorated by 38,000 meals ready to eat is quite obscene, to put it politely.
But that is what it has come to. The United States of America, a superpower, is unable or too afraid of the political consequences to force its relatively tiny ally, Israel, to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza to feed starving Palestinians. Now resorting to airdrops that create the impression of urgency, the illusion that the U.S. is willing to go to extraordinary lengths to save Palestinian lives.
Today, the United States airlifted 24.5 metric tons, or more than 54,000 pounds, of UN humanitarian supplies to provide.
It was more performative than practical, and had more to do with feeding news outlets imagery that suggests that America cares than getting Palestinians the food they need to survive.
When I saw the U.S. airdrop food, my first response was really anger. It was horror that this is apparently the best the US can do. Who is the superpower here? Is it the US or Israel? There is no place that's safe. There's no place where you can find reliable food and where people can get shelter. Gazans are exhausted, angry, and scared, and do not buy this argument that the US is suddenly caring about them by airdropping a handful of food.
People have compared these scenes to the Hunger Games, and for good reason. Airdrops is something you use in otherwise inaccessible geographic locations, a mountaintop, the middle of the jungle. What the U.S. has done is provide less meals than would have fit into a single truck. And the reason that these trucks aren't getting into the Gaza Strip is because there is a policy decision by Israel, fully endorsed, supported by the United States, to starve these people into submission.
So the Biden administration is essentially doing the least effective and most expensive method of getting aid to people that need it, because Israel simply won't concede to any American pressure on this one relatively simple point. And there is something dystopian about these airdrops and about the way that they pit people against each other.
I'm directing the U.S. military.
As if the airdrops aren't absurd or insulting enough, the Biden administration has now proposed building a port to deliver aid by ship. That would cost billions, take months to construct, while aid trucks are already parked on Gaza's doorstep. Currently, on the rare occasion when a truckload of food actually makes it into northern Gaza, this happens. The Flower Massacre in Gaza City, in which at least 112 Palestinians lining up for food were killed by Israeli forces. Israel then deployed its Hasbara, its disinformation machine, to pump even more fog into the war zone.
A mob ambushed the aid trucks, bringing the convoy to a halt.
It put out aerial images purporting to prove that Palestinians were to blame by charging at Israeli troops, and edited out the parts that showed them being shot, run over by Israeli tanks. Which is consistent with what has become a sickening pattern. As one human rights NGO, Euromed Monitor, put it, the Israeli shooting of starving Palestinian civilians receiving aid has become a regular practice.
A lot of Palestinians feared going there because they knew that the Israelis might just start shooting at them. And that's exactly what happened. And reports say that this went on for about an hour and a half. After it stopped, Palestinians went back to the aid trucks and they started shooting again. And this time they drove over the injured and dead bodies of Palestinians. Now, what unfolded in the media, how this was reported, it was a chaotic incident. A chaotic incident. This is a word that is used for someone storming a football field, not someone killing dozens of Palestinians who have not had food for days, for weeks.
Israel claimed from the beginning that there was a mob, it was a stampede. And that choice of words is so interesting because what that really suggests is an unruly crowd. These crazy Palestinians desperate for food, who knows what they're going to do, and we as Israeli soldiers are threatened. And that framing, which frankly too much of the media accepted too quickly.
It appears most who died were crushed by a crowd rushing the trucks, or were run down as those trucks, driven by Gazans, began to flee the mob scene.
So the Israeli military, seeing the damage that this massacre could cause, offered a fairly ludicrous explanation to blame Palestinians for their own deaths. And fairly quickly, we saw this explanation unravel.
It may have happened. Again, as I said before, it's a war zone. If it happened, I can say it happened by mistake.
Gunshot wounds didn't come from the aid trucks, they came from the Israeli military. But the U.S. continued to go along with this very threadbare Israeli explanation and not to hold Israel to account for this massacre.
Israel is creating new facts on the ground, cementing them into the landscape of Gaza. You can see it in the creation of a new buffer zone inside the border wall that would rob Gazans of roughly one-fifth of their land. And the paving of a new Israeli-built highway that slices the strip in two and will allow Israel to control security, the movement of people and goods.
These are familiar scenes now as hunger grips the entire population.
Much of the Western mainstream media is struggling to find the right way to describe what Israel is doing in Gaza, to come up with suitable terminology. Framing it as a humanitarian crisis disguises what it really is, an occupying power committing a genocide.
The Israelis are mapping out the strip. They are effectively acting as if they own it. They're trying to sell it as this place for Israelis and for Zionists specifically to come and live in. These are not stories we're hearing about. We're still hearing about the genocide and there is nothing to be done, when reality is the end is the annihilation of the Palestinians in Gaza if a ceasefire is not administered immediately.
That is where the Israeli authorities are struggling, in the construction of the news narrative.
Getting more aid to the people that need it, not to the Hamas fighters. We will work with our allies.
One wants the food to go to Hamas, not your allies, not you, but they do want it to go to starving babies.
As adept as they have been over the years at manipulating news coverage, misinforming audiences, that has proved to be no match for the evidence Palestinians have been posting and people around the world have been seeing on their feeds. And targeting Palestinian journalists in Gaza, killing them in record numbers, has not been enough to stop the truth coming out. Images that are reminiscent of another genocide that for Israelis hits close to home, the World War II Holocaust.
Social media has been a catastrophe for the Israelis. Yes, on the one hand, they can get their message out quite easily through TikTok, Instagram, whatever the platform may be. But there's so much content being pumped out from the Palestinian perspective that Israel doesn't know how to manage it. You can obfuscate and try to convince people that all the Gazans are terrorists, or every child in Gaza of 5 years old is a potential Hamas fighter. But who actually believes that?
Israel will, until the end of its days, be tainted by the accusation of genocide. Now that's bad for any state. And the difference here, in comparison with fairly recent genocides, is ironically, despite Israel's best efforts to keep journalists out of the Gaza Strip, no genocidal assault has been broadcast as extensively in real time as what we are seeing in the Gaza Strip over the past 5 months.
You've seen images of Palestinians and children in specific who have been so malnourished that they are dying. And they're going to haunt not just the reputation of Israel, but the entire world. We've seen these images from the Holocaust. What does it say for us to see it again? For it to be happening without anybody lifting a finger. And contrary to the past, these images are accessible. These crimes are documented. We need to make sure that history doesn't repeat itself, that the Palestinians do not become the victims of a new Holocaust.
To Egypt now, where journalists in the capital staged a daring protest over Gaza, pointing fingers close to home, and where the president's loyalists in the media have had to work overtime. Meenakshi Ravi is here with the details.
Ever since Israel launched its assault on Gaza, the war has been a delicate subject for President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and, by extension, the country's media. The chasm between the public outrage against Israel and Cairo's ambiguous approach to the war has led to censorship of news coverage and suppression of public protest. The exception is the Egyptian Journalist Syndicate. Multiple demonstrations have taken place. The latest, last Saturday, took aim at Arab governments. Not a single news outlet in Egypt reported on the protest, a sign of how sensitive this issue is for the Sisi government. Despite controlling, at least in theory, the Rafah crossing into southern Gaza, Cairo has remained largely passive, as Israel has blocked aid trucks and massacred Palestinian civilians seeking refuge there. It has also prevented journalists trying to get into Gaza. To help it save face, the government has a host of supporters in the media it can count on. Here's how some of them described progress on the delivery of aid last week. With the risk of an Israeli invasion of Rafah driving Palestinians over the Egyptian border, we can expect to see the propaganda and the policing of dissent go up a notch.
Thanks, Mina. For 5 months now, the Listening Post has covered Israel's war on Gaza through the prism of the media, including the unprecedented number of Palestinian journalists killed. But what is taking place in Gaza is much bigger. It is a genocidal assault on Palestinian history, existence, and culture. Most of Gaza's museums, universities, and libraries now lie in ruins. Too many cultural creators and custodians have been killed. And when South Africa invoked the Genocide Convention at the International Court of Justice, it noted that in Israel's destruction of Gaza's archives and landmarks, it is obliterating Palestinian personal lives, private memories, histories, and futures. This is not the first time Palestinian culture has been the target of Israeli destruction and looting. However, what has happened since October 7th has eclipsed anything we have seen before, including in the Nakba of 1948. What happens when cultural heritage is erased? Who controls the historical narrative, and to what effect? To grasp the enormity of what's been lost and what it means, we spoke to Gazan writer and historian Jihad Abu Salim.
To understand the scale of destruction in Gaza today, one needs to understand the nature of the war Israel has launched against Palestinians. We're not talking about conventional warfare. This is a war of annihilation that targets the foundations of society. We've seen universities bombed, libraries, museums. Israel is trying to prevent Palestinians from reclaiming and re-establishing life in Gaza as they knew it. My name is Jihad Abu Salim. I'm from the city of Deir al-Balah, located in the middle of the Gaza Strip. It's where I grew up and spent most of my life. Gaza City was the only Palestinian coastal city that was not conquered by Zionist militias in 1948. And that gave Gaza a huge significance and placed it as the beating heart of preserving Palestinian nationalism and furthering the Palestinian cause for liberation and emancipation. By destroying universities, museums, libraries, and archives, Israel seeks to make our memory, whether it's collective, institutional, inaccessible. It's an assault on continuity. They want to force people out of Gaza, but also they want to make sure that if people return to Gaza, they find nothing and dwell for eternity in this limbo of nothingness, in this void. Gaza's old city with its mosques like Al-Umari or a church like the Church of Saint Porphyrius testifies to Palestine's complex and multifaceted history. Al-Umari Mosque is the second oldest mosque in Palestine after Al-Aqsa Mosque. And from the footage that we've seen, it seems that the mosque was deliberately targeted because there are photos that show surrounding buildings standing intact, while the mosque has been bombed to smithereens. So Israel is trying to impose a rupture between the present and the past, and of course the future. And destroying an iconic structure like Al-Umari Mosque is just part of that effort. The goal of targeting Gaza's archives is to make it impossible for people to rebuild and reclaim what has been lost. We did not only lose historical documents, but also land deeds, land registration, infrastructure plans and schemes. Now we hear all these reports of people going back to their neighborhoods and being unable to recognize where the street that they lived on was located, where their homes were. And they think that by destroying institutions or archives or looting museums, they can destroy Gaza as a place and therefore prevent people from returning there or reestablishing their lives. Gaza and its district have suffered a lot in terms of the targeting and destruction of historic and heritage sites. After 1967, after Gaza became under Israeli occupation, Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Dayan built an entire infamous career, in addition to being a war criminal, of looting artifacts from different parts of Gaza and Palestine and storing them in his own home. But also in the 1970s and 80s, Israeli forces, alongside Israeli archaeologists, looted a 4,500-year-old Canaanite cemetery located in Deir el-Balah, my hometown, and they took anything they could carry to the Israel National Museum. And today, I go on the internet and I see artifacts that were stolen and looted from this site being sold around the world. And that makes you wonder if Israel's practices today are a new phenomenon or just a continuation of a long-standing pattern of destruction and looting of Palestinian history and culture. In this war alone, Palestinians in Gaza have lost towering figures in their society who shaped and defined the cultural and scholarly life in Gaza. And if there is one individual that captures the essence of this city and what it stands for, it's Rifat Larayr.
If the lions do not have their own historians, the history of the hunt will always glorify the hunters, will always glorify the occupier.
Rifat was killed while he was sheltering with his sister and her children. Before he was killed, he received a phone call from an Israeli officer warning him that they're after him. He was killed, his sister was killed, the children were killed, and his brother was also killed.
I am an academic. Probably the toughest thing I have at home is an Expo marker. But if the Israelis invade, if they charge at us, open door to door, to massacre us, I'm going to use that marker, throw it at the Israeli soldiers, even if that is the last thing that I would be able to do.
He was an important professor and a writer and a poet whose impact transcended his personal work to shaping and molding of a generation of English-speaking Palestinians in Gaza who mastered the art of telling their stories. But we've also lost a large number of cultural and literary figures, and of course, many academics. This is an assault on the people who create meaning in society and who create the language that helps people understand and reflect on their reality. Israel knew what it has been doing and continues to do by attacking and going after our cultural and literary and intellectual figures. But Rifat, like Gaza, is an idea, and ideas don't die. Bodies can perish, cities can be destroyed, but the ideas that they stand for, the principles and the values, these are things that do not just vanish into thin air. They continue to exist and to inspire people for many years to come.
Back to where we began, the crisis of aid in Gaza. A key factor in this, the accusations the Israeli government made in January against the biggest source of aid in Gaza, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. When Israel alleged UNRWA was harboring Hamas fighters, too many Western news outlets, foremost among them, the Wall Street Journal, simply bought the story. The U.S. and multiple other governments then pulled their funding, despite the ridiculously scant evidence that Israel provided, starving UNRWA of the money it needs to help Palestinians. The EU and Canada have now announced they will resume funding. In Canada's case, that will take time, something the people of Gaza simply do not have. Of all the crimes against journalism since October 7th, the way the UNRWA episode was reported is one that will weigh heavily on the conscience of the journalists and news editors involved, or at least it should. We'll see you next time here at The Listening Post.